Hi, and welcome to the fifth episode of our special podcast series focused on medicinal herbs and their unique place in the holistic approach to health. Today, host and nutritionist Sarah Lebrun-Blaschke talks with naturopath and medical herbalist Baris Burgoyne, who has been in practice for more than 25 years. Today's herbal topic is cat's claw, an herb used traditionally as a tonic and for inflammatory conditions and cancer.
So I'm so excited to be here today to have a conversation about cat's claw with Baris Burgoyne, who is a naturopathic practitioner in Australia and really an expert in this area of cat's claw. And so, Baris, we're so happy to have you today. You know, as we're thinking about cat's claw, it's one of those herbs that are kind of unique and interesting. Can you tell me a little bit about cat's claw and how it's being utilized as an herbal supplement?
Look, we're really lucky to have cat's claw, actually. And I haven't had it available in my clinic for some time, but I have it again now, and I'm very excited about that. And, you know, I'd like to talk a little bit about how we come to have cat's claw. Indeed, many of the herbs that we have in our clinics using as herbal supplements. And, you know, the majority of them would have been used and are still used by traditional cultures around the world. And, you know, scientists kind of look at these traditional cultures to find out, you know, what are they using and how they're using them. And we are with the idea of developing drugs from plants. And, you know, when we talk about cat's claw, we're talking about the Amazonian rainforest, where it predominantly grows. And scientists have been searching that area for over 100 years with the hope of finding plants so that they can develop new drugs. And as part of that, they'll talk to the traditional people, find out, you know, what are you using in this area and how are you using it? And that gives them an idea about what plants they might want to look at. And then when they get them back to their laboratories, what sort of active constituents they might be looking at based on the traditional use, et cetera. It's a really long, long process. But, you know, the Amazonian rainforest just holds a wealth of potential medicines, both herbal and allopathic. And there's a great deal of concern in the scientific community that plant species that haven't even been found yet are being lost because of all the logging and destruction that's happening in areas of the Amazonian rainforest. Cat's claw came to the attention of the European scientific community in the 1970s after an Austrian scientist heard about its healing qualities and became very interested in it. And, you know, obviously the common name is cat's claw. Botanical name is Uncaria tomentosa. And a really important point I'd like to make here is that there's many, many plants around the world that are called cat's claw. And why is that the case? If you've ever seen an image of cat's claw, and I'm sure most of you have, it's called cat's claw because it has those distinctive thorns or barbs on it that help it climb up and attach to the trees in the rainforest so it can reach the canopy. That's how all vines grow. And the traditional name in central Peru is Una de Gato, which is Spanish and translates to cat's claw. And many, many climbing plants have those distinctive claws, so they're called cat's claw. And we have to always make sure that we have the right plant. And, you know, I've been a naturopath in Australia for over 30 years. And during that time, I've spoken to two or three practitioners that I've come across at seminars who've said, oh, you know, I've got cat's claw growing on my property. Do you know how I could make a herbal extract out of it? And my advice always is don't, because you definitely will not have Uncaria tomentosa.
Yeah.
It grows in tropical rainforest. It doesn't grow in a back garden in Sydney or Brisbane. It just doesn't. You might have a plant that's locally called cat's claw, but it's not Uncaria tomentosa. So, you know, if we look at that Uncaria species, there's two species that grow in Central and South America. One of those is Uncaria tomentosa, the species that we use as a herbal supplement. The other one is Uncaria guanensis. And that was used somewhat traditionally, but it's the tomentosa that we use. But if you look throughout Asia and Africa, there's another 30, 32, 34 species of Uncaria. And I've read something that James Duke wrote once, which I found, you know, really interesting. And that was that even in Peru, there's been at least 20 plants from 12 different families over time that have been called Una de Gato. So we can't rely on common names of plants in any area to think we've got the correct herb. We have to actually do all the testing. We have to make sure that we have the correct species. We have to make sure we also have the correct chemotype. And I'll talk about chemotypes in a moment. But I would just like to relate, if you'd like to indulge me just for a moment.
Sure.
And I had in Peru, and I was a few years ago, I had the privilege of staying in the Peruvian rainforest. And I asked one of the guides where I stayed, does Una de Gato grow in this area? And he said, yes. So he took me for a walk through the jungle, you know, quite a way, and showed me this plant. It certainly had the claws on it. Whether it was Uncaria tomentosa or not, I don't know. I'm a herbalist. I'm not a botanist. But it was a very exciting experience for me, thinking that, wow, you know, this very plant could be harvested and in my clinic one day. You know, I do get very excited by that sort of thing. But, you know, we do have to make sure we've got the correct species. We do have to make sure we've got the correct chemotype.
I think that's a really important distinction, right? Because there are many plants in many different herbs that have similar names or similar looks. And so, you know, the chemotype is so important. So can you explain a little bit more what that means? What is chemotype?
Okay, a chemotype is when we have a particular genus and species of herb or plant, they're going to look identical. I mean, just looking at them, and botanically they are identical, but their phytochemistry is different. Mm-hmm. And there's no way of knowing what chemotype you have unless you do laboratory testing. And so that's very, very important. So when a manufacturer is producing a herbal supplement, they need to know this information. They need to know how to test for different chemotypes. And that doesn't just apply to cat's claw. It occurs to other plants as well. With Uncaria tomentosa, there's three different chemotypes, and two of them contain one of the major active constituents or group of constituents called pentacyclic oxindole alkaloids, or POAs for short, is what most of us know them as. So two of the chemotypes contain high levels of POAs, and they contain little or no of the other group of alkaloids, tetracyclic oxindole alkaloids, or TOAs. The third species contains predominantly TOAs, and it's the POA chemotypes that we use medicinally. And it's certainly that's a chemotype that's been used traditionally by the Ashaninka traditional people that live in central Peru. And that's where we initially learned about cat's claw. And interestingly enough, we have to take the plants to a lab. We have to do very expensive and very elaborate laboratory testing to find out which chemotype we have. The Ashaninka priests are able to distinguish the different chemotypes without any of that. They just know which chemotype is which, and they always use the POA chemotypes. So that tells us immediately that that's what we need to be using. And of course, there is some research now to actually support that.
Isn't that fascinating that, you know, the traditional people didn't need all that laboratory work to figure out what it was? So they must have done it maybe by taste or visually.
I don't know. It's quite interesting. And I think it's very humbling when you hear things like that, or it should be humbling. And, you know, I think we have, you know, we all think we're very clever, and we are in many, many ways. But, You know, there's a lot of people that have been more clever than we are even now for thousands of years.
Right.
You know, who live close to the earth and who are very much in touch with it.
Yeah. So I think that's really interesting, you know, how the ability for them traditionally to figure out the POAs, but now we know the plant sources that have the high POAs are the ones that have been more traditionally used to support health in many ways. Can you talk a little bit maybe about some of the clinical studies now that have come on, you know, in our more, you know, recent scientific information versus where it was traditionally used, and what does that look like?
Sure. Yeah. When scientists find a new plant that they're interested in, then of course they do lots of different testing, in vitro testing, in vivo testing, and eventually clinical trials if the plant looks promising. And of course they do this with the idea of developing drugs. But as a spin-off of that, we as herbalists get a huge amount of information about how the herbs are working. And in most cases, that research supports traditional use. It's not always the case, but in most cases, it supports traditional use. And there have been a number of studies looking at cat's claw, predominantly looking at preventing infection for treating immune deficiency disorders or immune depletion, but also for inflammatory disorders like arthritis, predominantly rheumatoid, but also osteoarthritis. And there's been some really good quality studies, but unfortunately, in some of the studies, it's not clear what plant part they actually used. And, you know, I've talked about the correct genus and species, the correct chemotype, but once we've got all that, we have to make sure we're using the correct plant part as well. And traditionally, they used the root bark and the stem bark, and it appears that all of these different parts of the plants were used for the same uses. They also, you do see reference sometimes to traditional people using the leaf, but there's not a lot of information about that. I actually use a cat's claw product in my clinic that is made from the stem bark. And one of the reasons I really like that extract is that by harvesting the stem bark, you've got better sustainability. Because what they do is they cut the plant off round about, you know, 10 to 100 millimeters or 20 to 100 millimeters or so above the ground, harvest it, and then that allows the plant to regenerate and grow. But you can imagine if you're using the root or the root bark, you can harvest that sustainably, but it's much more difficult and, you know, you don't have a lot of room for error there. So, and one thing we definitely don't want to be doing with the herbs that we use is adding to the possibility of them becoming extinct. And we know that that's the case with some of the plants that we use. And in fact, there's some that I had available in my early days of practice that I don't have available now because they're on the CITES list for endangered plants. You know, we don't want to do it from an environmental point of view, but we certainly don't want to do it from a clinical point of view either. We need to ensure sustainability. Around about the mid-90s, the Peruvian government actually started to regulate the export of cat's claw because, of course, once we in the West and, you know, people with money then start exploiting traditional medicines and, you know, these people have to be very, very onto it to stop or at least contain that. It's very beneficial for them because, of course, it brings money into quite what is quite often poorer areas, but it has to be well managed. And so, you know, they regulated it around the mid-90s. And I think it was in the late 90s, around about 99, they dictated that, you know, all harvested cat's claw, especially for export, has to be harvested from natural stock or, you know, well-managed natural stock or plantations. So, you know, that's another responsibility that we have when we're using herbs is to make sure that they're ethically sourced.
Right.
You know, not only are we not adding to the risk of extinction, but we're also supporting the people on whose land we're getting those herbs. I think that that's very, very important.
Yeah, that is really important. You know, we don't, especially when we're going around the world finding herbs that have, you know, key distinct outcomes, that we want to make sure that, as you said, they're there for, you know, a long time, and we can continue to have them for generations to generations. But then the people who are growing and utilizing them are supported by growing them.
Yeah. And there's many instances where, you know, traditional people have been so exploited. And, you know, I've seen documentaries on the First Nations people in America saying, we don't want to give any information about our traditional medicines because then we don't have access to our own plants.
Right.
And, you know, we've seen in Australia the same thing. A lot of the Indigenous people, the ones that still have some of that old knowledge, they don't necessarily want to be just giving it away, and rightly so. Mm-hmm.
Right.
So we do need to be very responsible.
So you talked about in your clinic you're using a stem extract, right? Can you talk about how you use it and what patients would benefit from the cat's claw extract?
It's a stem bark extract. Look, there's a lot of uses for cat's claw, and the ones that really interest me and the way that I use it in my clinic is to really work with the tonic activity that it has, and the you know, if you look at the traditional uses, it's tonic, it's used for convalescing, helping people to recover from illness, help support immunity. So that's the main way that I use cat's claw in my clinic. So if I have a patient come in who's had an illness, it's often an infectious illness, but it doesn't need to be any sort of illness where, you know, we want to help people recover, they're depleted, they're tired, they're not doing well after the illness, then we can give herbs. And one of the key herbs that I use there is cat's claw.
And do you use it by itself, or will you use it in combination with others? And like, how do you in your practice determine when to use which herbs?
It's a great question. Thank you. Look, I rarely would use a single herb. I might use, you know, a single liquid sometimes. I might use a tablet containing a single herb sometimes, but it would be combined with other herbal supplements and nutritional supplements. Mm-hmm. And, you know, with cat's claw, if I'm dealing with a patient who's come in and they're just feeling depleted after an illness, then, you know, the main things, particularly if it's infectious, but really anything, I use a combination of echinacea, eleuthero, astragalus, and ashwagandha. Okay. And for me, those are fantastic herbs for helping to build immunity after an illness or infection, but also they're all tonic and adaptogenic herbs. Mm. So they increase energy, they increase well-being, they help a person convalesce. You know, we don't, you know, once upon a time, if people had money, they could convalesce after an illness. You often see in old British movies, they go off to the seaside to convalesce. We don't do that these days. You know, we keep working when we're not well, and many people are forced to. So I believe that these herbs help to do the job that convalescing used to do. Of course, if you can rest and take the herbal supplements, that is better still. We should be resting. But either way, these herbal supplements work really well. And I had a case recently where a patient that I see intermittently and have for years rang me and said she had shingles. And, you know, she said it's not a very severe attack, but what can I do? She wasn't able to come in and see me. So, and certainly in the current situation, you don't want anyone with something like shingles going out into the community. You really want them staying home.
Right.
So I sent her some, you know, immune herbs and some antiviral herbs to help deal with that. And she rang me about 3 weeks later and she said, look, I got over that acute very quickly. But she said, I just can't recover. I'm exhausted and I'm not sleeping well. And by midday, I just can't do a single thing for the rest of the day. I just have to lie on the couch. So, and she doesn't have very much money. I'm well aware of that. She still had some of the other herbal supplements. So she was taking those at lower dose, which I told her to continue doing. And so I gave her those herbs. I gave her one tablet that I use that has echinacea, eleuthero, and astragalus in it. And I said, look, let's try with this and we'll see how we go. And mm-hmm. she rang me 2 or 3 days later and said, I cannot believe how much better I feel.
Right.
And I didn't have cat's claw in at that point. That was before mm-hmm. I actually had it back in my clinic. But if I'd had the cat's claw, I would have added the cat's claw to that. And but she just said, look, I can't believe the difference that I feel just mm-hmm. in a few days. It's like a miracle. So, but the idea is not to sort of say, oh, great, you're feeling better, stop it. I tell people after an illness, they need to take that combination for, you know, up to 3 months, depending on how serious the illness was. If it was something like Epstein-Barr virus or cytomegalovirus, or if you're dealing with someone with Lyme disease or something, then I would say once they get over the acute, you need to take this for 3 months. I don't care how wonderful you might start feeling in that time, continue it for 3 months, because we'll often see relapse of those conditions.
Right.
We'll see relapse of fatigue, etc. And I think carrying on for that length of time really helps protect people. I may not do that with this patient because she didn't have a severe attack and she responded very quickly, but at least a month, I'd be saying continue on, you know, what you're doing, just to ensure that you've got full recovery. So you can see quite miraculous results sometimes.
So would you say it's also safe for children who maybe are also recovering from some sort of illness?
No, look, it's recommended that children under 3 aren't given it. That's a recommendation out of Europe. And yeah, it's just because there's no data on safety in children. And I don't think I've ever used it in a child. And to be quite honest, I'm not sure that you would need to.
Right.
You know, if I have a child come to me with, you know, low immunity, they're getting frequent infections, et cetera, or maybe they just run down, they're finicky eaters, you know, just that typical picture that we often see in young children. And, you know, and you'll often see kids after they start going to daycare or childcare.
Right.
And they will just get one infection after another in that sort of situation until their immune system develops more. They get used to the exposure to a whole range of organisms. But the unfortunate thing is that very often those children are put on repeated courses of antibiotics to deal with the infections, which just complicates everything further and adds not only to the antimicrobial resistance, but also it damages their gut flora, which you definitely do not want to be doing in a young child because they haven't even finished developing and evolving their gut flora yet. So the combination that I use and I've always loved is a combination of ashwagandha and echinacea.
Okay.
And that combination in those kids is just phenomenal. It will pick their immune systems up. It picks their energy up. If they're finicky eaters, their appetite improves and it gets them eating better. And, you know, when I've treated children in that situation, I've had parents from the same center call me and say, oh, I want an appointment. I want to get some of that stuff that little Johnny's got, you know, because it's working so well.
That's awesome.
So, yeah, I think that combination is great. And any situations where we have cat's claw and it's may not be such a safe herb to use, there's always others that we can replace it with. And that's a fortunate thing about herbal medicine. There's often alternatives, and sometimes they're not quite as wonderful as the one you might be primarily wanting to use, but there are other substitutes. So we can manage those situations very well most of the time.
What about, you know, cat's claw for either a pregnant or a lactating mother?
It is contraindicated in pregnancy. And that's based on the fact that there's been some animal studies showing that it can have harmful effects. Mm-hmm. These sorts of studies are never done in humans for very good reason. Wouldn't get past any sort of ethics committee, and nor should it. It's also recommended that women trying to conceive don't take it as well, because one of the traditional uses was as a contraceptive, but it was used in very high dose. And I haven't been able to find any information on what type of medicine was used, whether it was a decoction and infusion, whether it was the dry bark, whatever it was. But, you know, for that reason, we had advised women trying to conceive better not to take it. And, you know, on that note, you know, if I'm doing a live seminar, invariably I'll have somebody come up to the to me in the break with this sort of situation and say, oh, do you think you could use cat's claw as a contraceptive instead of a contraceptive or something? And my advice is always, no, absolutely not. You're playing with fire there. We have no information about how it was used traditionally or even how effective it was traditionally. Right. We don't know. With regard to lactation, there's really no data, so it's recommended to use it cautiously. I interpret that to be don't use it at high dose. But, you know, in that sort of situation, and considering it is contraindicated in young children, again, because of lack of data, and I haven't seen any information on the pharmacokinetics and, you know, what might get into breast milk, etc. So personally, I wouldn't use it in lactating women either. Whatever I was using it for, then I would use something else. And quite often in those women, you're doing it because they're exhausted, they're fatigued, sleep deprived, etc. So again, you know, things like ashwagandha would be my favorite. But having said all that, one of the traditional uses that is listed is as a tonic after childbirth, which would imply it's being used in lactating women. But again, we don't know the dosage. We don't know how it was used. So personally, I act cautiously because, yeah, women are very emotive when they're pregnant, very protective, and when they're breastfeeding. So I don't want to do anything that might raise alarm bells for them.
Would there be other safety concerns that you would want, you know, somebody who may not benefit from them because it's contraindicated?
There's a few cases, as with all immune herbs, you'd want to be careful in people taking immune suppressive drugs, particularly for if they've had a bone marrow transplant or if they've had an organ transplant. And that's even more the case if it's happened within 12 months. But, you know, I wouldn't use cat's claw in that situation. There's been some side effects reported in clinical studies. Diarrhea, constipation, indigestion. So some more digestive sort of issues, they've happened. They seem to happen early on in the treatment. So if it's going to happen, it will probably happen early on. So, you know, I haven't actually seen that in clinical practice myself. But whenever I do have patients say to me, since I've been taking that supplement, you know, I've got diarrhea, I've got stomach pains or whatever, then I say, okay, well, it's not something I've seen in somebody before, but look, let's stop taking it until the symptom resolves and then maybe start it again. You know, depending on the dose they're on, you might start it at a lower dose and then just build it up again and see how that goes. Very often the symptom they have is nothing to do with the supplement. It's just coincidental. But, you know, we need to err on the side of caution and we need to take what the patient is saying seriously. We can't just dismiss it and say, no, that's not possible, because we have no idea whether it's possible or not. Mm-hmm. We have, you know, we all see in clinical practice idiosyncratic reactions in one person that we would never see in anybody else and would be totally unexpected and not predictable, really.
Right. So cat's claw is one of these really interesting herbs that we here in the U.S. have had limited access to recently. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we find making sure that we have the right type with the high POAs. Can you just give us some, like, last thoughts on who's that right patient and what is the real thing that they need to look for if we're talking about cat's claw for a patient?
Well, first of all, the cat's claw I use tells me on the label the level of POAs. So I know that it's been tested and that it's the right chemotype, etc. Tells me that immediately, so I can use that confidently in my clinic. And, you know, the type of person, as I said earlier, is person that comes in, is very depleted, and often that's after an illness. It's not always after an illness, but it's often after an illness, and it really is a phenomenal herb to help them recover. I have used it sometimes in patients with arthritis, probably more often rheumatoid arthritis than osteoarthritis. In that instance, I would combine it with other anti-inflammatory herbs like boswellia and turmeric, maybe the bioavailable curcumin that is available now, sometimes the willow bark extract. So it really just depends a little bit on, you know, what's going on for the patient, what I combine it with, but I would combine it with other anti-inflammatory herbs. And in the case of something like rheumatoid arthritis, which is an autoimmune disease, I would always add echinacea in there because that's great at modulating the immune system in autoimmune diseases. So, you know, cat's claw has very wide application, and what we combine it with depends on, you know, how the patient actually presents to us and what their main complaints are, and also what else is going on for them, because all herbs have multiple actions.
Well, Ferris, I think this was just such a great conversation about cat's claw, from the history of where it came from and how you could utilize it in clinic to really make a difference by itself and with other herbs in your patients. I really appreciate the time today, and thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure. Thank you very much.
For more on cat's claw and other medicinal herbs, visit holisticmatters.com. That's holistic with a W. We'll have a variety of time-stamped references and notes from today on the podcast page for this episode. And if you missed last month's episode, don't forget to check it out to hear an in-depth conversation on bitter herbs. We'll be back in October, again on the first Friday of the month, with more on herbal medicine. This podcast was brought to you by the Holistic Matters podcast series from holisticmatters.com, powered by Standard Process. The music featured on this episode comes from a song called New Day by Lee Rosevere, licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution License.